This week on the Writer's Detective Bureau, transsexual protagonists, Inside Man, and romance undercover. I'm Adam Richardson, and this is the Writer's Detective Bureau. Welcome to episode number 71 of the Writer's Detective Bureau, the podcast dedicated to helping authors and screenwriters write professional quality crime-related fiction. This week, I'm answering your questions about how human resources at a police department would handle confidentiality of a transsexual employee, poking plot holes through the movie Inside Man, and handling romance while undercover. But first, I need to thank Gold Shield patrons Deborah Dunbar from DeborahDunbar.com, Cece Jamison of CeceJamison.com, Larry Keaton, Vicky Tharp of VickyTharp.com, Chris Ann, Larry Darter, Natalie Borelli of NatalieBorelli.com, Craig Kingsman of CraigKingsman.com, and Joan Raymond of JoanRaymondWritingAndDesign.com for their support. I also want to send a huge thank you to my Coffee Club patrons. I really do appreciate each and every one of you. You can find links to all of the writers supporting this episode in the show notes at writersdetective.com/71. To learn about setting up your own Patreon account for your author business, or to support this show for as little as $2 per month, visit writersdetective.com/Patreon. P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Welcome back to the Bureau. I had an unintentional one-week hiatus, a little more than 1 week, actually, due to a sinus and upper respiratory infection, which kept me in bed and sounding horrible for over a week. Well, I still sound horrible, so I apologize for that, but the show must go on. So let's get into this week's first question. Tony Dutson writes, I'm one of those who found the Writer's Detective Bureau through the Creative Pen podcast and love your work. I also have a sticky question for the Bureau. When Hollywood went into overdrive by flipping characters' sexual preferences, they've done better lately, I wanted to write a trans anti-hero, like a trans Dexter or Hannibal Lecter. My character goes through the complete sex reassignment surgery, female to male, before becoming a CSI. My question is, how much of his reassignment will be revealed by the hiring process, and will that information be kept confidential? Will senior officers be informed, or will HR keep the reassignment confidential? Great questions, Tony. I will confess that I know very little about labor law or human relations, human resources work, but I do know that their primary focus is to maintain an inclusive and safe workspace. So for starters, if your character transitioned prior to being employed by the police department, then it's a non-issue. The department can't even ask about gender as part of the hiring process. Applicants for police officer positions do go through full-on medical examinations, but it sounds like your character is more of a civilian crime scene investigation specialist or forensic technician or serologist or, you know, however you want to classify the title. Those jobs as a civilian likely don't have the same kind of medical exam as part of the hiring process. But even if it was disclosed, then yes, it would be kept confidential. Now, if a supervisor came to HR and inquired, now, regardless of whether HR knew any of those details about their employee, that would likely be treated as an effort to single out that employee and should spur its own inquiry. I guess walking into HR and asking the gender of an employee, you know, especially of a subordinate, is not normal workplace behavior. I'm pretty sure no one's ever walked into my HR asking about my gender, you know, so who does that? The answer is that it's someone who's looking to make it an issue, and that's a big red flag. From statistics that I've read, 90% of people identifying as transsexual report sexual harassment in the workplace. 90%. And I can only imagine that percentage would be even higher in law enforcement, unfortunately. I personally would hazard a guess that the other 10% in that survey didn't trust the surveyor enough to admit it in the survey without fear of repercussion. The HR department would certainly know that trans employees are at the highest risk for sexual harassment, and assuming it's a labor law abiding office, or at the very least, HR's goal is to prevent, you know, being sued or being accused of equal opportunity law violations, that they would do their best to prevent any kind of harassment or exclusion of their employees. I would hope.
You've been transferred to personnel.
To personnel? That's for assholes.
I can tell you that I have met three trans women working in law enforcement over the course of my career, all three of whom transitioned after starting their law enforcement career. So their transition from male to female was common knowledge amongst their peers within their respective agencies. So, Tony, I applaud you for writing more gender diverse characters than mainstream media typically portrays. My only word of caution for anyone writing a trans character is to create these characters and stories in a genuine way and not simply throw in gender diversity elements like a token to make your story more marketable to Hollywood. I've talked about the power of story many times on this podcast, and in the police procedural or crime fiction genres, I think we need to be mindful of the fact that our LGBTQ characters in our stories may be the first time that a reader or viewer who is contemplating transition or has transitioned can actually see themselves as being able to pursue a career in law enforcement while still being able to live their true life. Just keep that in mind as you create your stories. So thank you so much for the question, Tony. I really appreciate it. This week's next question is probably the one I've held on to the longest. This came from Chris A. Moody from chrisamoody.com. Chris writes, "Hey Adam, here are some questions from How Realistic Is This Movie? After a recent rewatch of The Inside Man, it left me wondering," and he lists three questions. The first question is, "Assuming a group pulled off the crime as well as they did in the movie, would anyone notice that one room was all of a sudden several feet smaller? Second question, at the end, if no one was pressuring the cops to figure out what happened, would it become a non-incident as described in the movie? And third, how likely is it that by the end, the lead detective would make the connection to possible war crimes being the catalyst of the whole thing? Thanks, Chris." If you haven't seen the movie Inside Man, it stars Denzel Washington, Clive Owen, Jodie Foster, Willem Dafoe. I mean, the list goes on. But if you haven't seen it, this is going to be filled with spoilers. But the movie's 13 years old, so I'm not feeling that guilty about this. You've been warned. So as a bit of a refresher, since it's been quite a while, the plot of the movie is a clever bank robbery crew takes over a Manhattan bank, seemingly steals nothing, uses toy guns, which we learn toward the end, and most of the robbery crew escapes with the hostages, like as appears to be one of the hostages. So they make it seemingly impossible for the police to determine which of the hostages were actually part of the robbery crew. Now, the ringleader, played by Clive Owen, secrets himself behind a false wall in a supply room inside the bank for the week following the robbery, ultimately walking out the front door of the bank with a pocket full of diamonds in broad daylight while the bank has once the bank has reopened. So the biggest diamond in the safety deposit box, which the robbers leave behind, is actually set in a Cartier ring that we learn is evidence of the bank's founder being a Nazi war criminal. Okay. First of all, I thoroughly enjoyed this movie when it came out, and I enjoyed it again when I rewatched it to answer this question, mainly because of the clever twists in the story. It's very well told. But make no mistake, there are a host of plot holes when it comes to how the case would really have been worked. So I'll start with Chris's first question. The unlocked supply room in the basement of the bank that any member of the public has free access to? Well, that is a bit dubious, if not extremely convenient. I mean, would anyone notice the resized room? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But the last time we see the cops inside the supply room is a clue as to why they'd actually pay a lot more attention to the room during the evidence collection phase, increasing the likelihood of it being discovered that there's a little false wall. And it's one of my favorite plot holes. So the scene I'm talking about is after they've gone into the bank and everyone's out, and the police discover the bags of clothing that were taken from the hostages. The hostage clothing is the reconstructable puzzle that the screenwriter kind of ignores for the sake of making this story work. When the robbery starts, the four robbers come in and disable the cameras immediately and lock the doors. The police already have the surveillance footage from the bank, which means they already have a video account of who was in the bank and what they were wearing before the robbers came in. So, using the bags of clothing and the video surveillance, the detectives could painstakingly account for who arrived in regular clothes, leaving the hostages without the clothing in the bags as three of our five suspects. So that's a pretty good start. Now, the fourth suspect is our ringleader, who's been hidden behind a false wall, so his clothing's not in play. So the only suspect that might actually get away with being unidentified would be the rabbi with the hearing aids, because he was in the bank talking to a manager at the time the robbery starts. So his clothing would have gone into the bag with the rest of the other hostages. But everyone else was wearing a jumpsuit when they came in. All right, Chris's second question is, at the end, if no one was pressuring the cops to figure out what happened, would it become a non-incident as described in the movie? So in this scene, you have Denzel's boss, a police captain, pretty much tell him, you know, make this go away, bury it, because nobody's looking for answers, so we have other things to do. Reality is no. Truthfully, this is a federally insured bank, and that would make this the FBI's jurisdiction as well. You don't see any FBI getting involved in this case throughout this movie. And you don't lock down a full city block for a full day and then not investigate what happened because some captain thinks he isn't going to get heat from the bosses. There are a litany of crimes that occurred, even if nothing was taken in a classic bank robbery kind of scenario. And in the end, there really was a robbery. Just because the two detectives and the tactical team didn't figure it out during the first walkthrough doesn't mean a major crime didn't occur. In reality, there would be a ton of follow-up investigation to be had. Every safety deposit box owner would be contacted and urged to check the contents of their box. A full audit on the computer side of things would occur as well. There's a lot more money to be had through the computer access than there is sitting in the vault. So what's to say the robbers weren't actually wiring money or installing a computer virus? I mean, there are a million other things that could have occurred other than just put dollar bills into bags. Bosses telling detectives not to investigate is also not a thing. Investigating is what we do. And in this case, you follow the money or the ring. And that takes time and perseverance. Would the hostage negotiator be the one to do it? Probably not, but the financial crimes detectives and obviously the FBI would. If anything, the bosses would want to figure out what the heck happened because they just spent a lot of money and operational costs responding to this thing, and they're still cops. They used to be detectives and they used to be patrol officers. They don't like bad guys getting away either. Furthermore, at the end of the movie, Denzel figures out that the ringleader bumped into him at the bank during the delayed getaway, having slipped a diamond in his coat pocket. Since we see that the bank is back open and operational, the detectives could go back and view the surveillance video that we can assume has been fixed because the bank is up and running again. So find the spot on the video where Denzel walks in and the bump from Clive Owens happens, and then work backward, tracing Clive's steps back to the supply room. There's a week's worth of smelly DNA in that false room. And for that matter, you'd think a windowless supply room would reek after a week of someone living in there, or even a couple days, especially since the false wall is like thin panels and wood. But anyway, for Chris's third question, I don't know how likely it would be for the detective to figure out the war crimes angle, because the audience knows far more than the detective does at that point. But the follow the ring note obviously sends him in the right direction. I would guess that there's more to this subplot that got left on the cutting room floor to keep the pacing and the movie length on track. So it's kind of a bit hard to speculate on that one. So the real question is, how did the robbery crew know about Safety Deposit Box 392 and its contents to begin with? Thanks for being so patient and waiting for these answers, Chris. I appreciate it. You can find Chris's work at chrisamoody.com. Lori Sibley writes, I was listening to some past podcasts, and episode 53 had another question about undercover cops. Those answers have been swirling around in the plot bunny part of my brain. I'm a romance writer, so of course I'm wondering about UC cops and falling in love. Would a UC start a relationship with someone he meets while on the job? When the job is over or he's pulled, can that relationship continue? How often does a UC check in with his handler, and how does he do that? Does he completely disappear from family members like a dad or sister, or is he able to check in with them periodically? Thanks for feeding my bunny. You know, I heard a stand-up comic once joke that for men, falling in love is like stepping in poop. It's surprising, often inconvenient, and you can't get it off. Based on your question, Lori, I'm assuming this is a deep cover kind of assignment for your UC. And by that, I mean it's a long-term investigation. So relationships do become very tricky. For starters, there's the obvious problem of starting your new relationship with a lie. The first thing we learn, and in my case, usually forget, about someone when you meet them is their name. And if the very first thing you learn about someone is a lie, it debases your entire ability to trust them once you learn it was a lie, because you question your entire ability to spot lies or liars. And in this case, that's what a love interest would view the UC as once she finds out who he really is. Whether the UC could continue a relationship after the investigation would really have to do with the case itself, if we got past the trust issue. If the love interest is a neighbor in the new apartment that the UC is quote-unquote living in, then that's far more likely to continue than if the relationship is with someone that is a suspect or a witness in the case. If they have any ties to the organization being investigated, then not only would the relationship have to end, that would be part of their defense attorney's argument as to why their client did anything witnessed or for the UC that was criminal. So your UC has to be very careful who he gets involved with. And to answer your specific question, would a UC start a relationship with someone he meets on the job? If you're talking about someone that is part of the investigation, that is a definite no. A relationship means you are getting close to someone. And the more you're around anyone affiliated with the target of your investigation, the more likely it is the UC is going to screw up by saying something or being recognized by someone while that UC is with the love interest and they're together. So those are the kind of things that the UC is going to be worrying about. As a UC and as a handler for the UC, you want to be in as much control of the interactions with your targets as possible. Falling in love with one of them makes that impossible. And like I just mentioned, it's going to hurt you in court later on. How often a UC checks in is really up to the UC and the handler to determine. And as a matter of tradecraft, I'm not going to go into too much more detail than that. Same with how they'd contact one another. But in this digital age, getting in contact with people is a constant of daily life, so you can leave that up to whatever works best for your story. Whether the UC is able to stay in contact with family really depends on their situation. If you're working a case that is in a really remote area with no cell service, that's going to be a whole lot more difficult than slipping out of town to go see a family member in the next city. UC work is volunteer, so the family is most likely going to know that this is part of his job. So it's not like they just vanish from their desk one day. Well, unless you write it that way. But no UC assignment ever goes as planned, so definitely have fun with it. Thanks for the question, Lori. Thanks for listening this week. If you enjoyed this episode, I would love it if you left me a review on iTunes. It helps spread the word about our little bureau. Thanks again for listening, and happy holidays.